from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, Google's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt, says that between Facebook and cloud computing, your digital identity will live forever. Schmidt and his co-author, Jared Cohen, will join us in studio to talk about their book, The New Digital Age, which explores how online connectivity is changing censorship, privacy, and activism in countries like Mexico, China, and North Korea, and elsewhere around the world. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. As billions more will be coming online in the next decade, what will the likely effect of such global interconnectivity be on individuals and nation states? Well, Google CEO Eric Schmidt and director of Google Ideas, Jared Cohen, team up to take on that and other pressing questions on the ongoing and rampant advance of technology. They recently published a co-authored book, The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. Eric Schmidt is executive chairman of Google and served from 2001 to 2011 as the company's chief executive officer. He also chairs the board of the New America Foundation. Jared Cohen directs Google Ideas and is an adjunct senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, as well as being a Rhodes Scholar and author of Children of Jihad and 100 Days of Silence. We welcome both of you to the studio.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you both here. And boy, just looking at this book and looking at the plugs on the back, I was doing that with Mark Bittman in the last hour. Steve Jobs, author Walter Isaacson, Bill Clinton, Henry Kissinger, Madeleine Albright, Tony Blair. Who's got more pull here where the blurbs are concerned?
I'd say it's Jared.
I would say it's Eric.
Yeah,
so
that's what
we
I figured.
We can debate amongst ourselves.
Predicted that. And you might have predicted that I started off asking about privacy because it's also such a big concern to listeners of this program, and you talk about it in the book, and Gavin Newsom was on. He also wrote a book called Citizenville, which has curious kinds of topical resemblances, since there is no privacy anymore.
Well, let's start by saying that when we started this book, we tried to figure out what was going to happen, and we concluded that the next 5 billion that will join this sort of internet phenomena, people over the next 5 to 10 years will get enormous improvements of education and information and access and healthcare. Their worlds will go from absolutely knowing nothing to knowing everything. They're going to join our conversation. The world will be safer as a result. But it creates a lot of problems, right, with all of these people and all good people as well as bad people. And whether it's the way governments behave or issues of privacy or copyright or so forth, we've got to sort those out as well.
Jared Cohen.
And Michael, one of the things that Eric and I talk a lot about in the book is the important role that parents will play in the future. So I would imagine you have a lot of parents listening to this show, and so it will come as no surprise to them that we're interested in this question of what happens as young kids come online younger and faster than at any other time in history, when they're not physically mature enough to understand the implications for what they say and do online at a young age. What does that mean?
And I actually read of something you posted on Facebook. You said, let's talk about privacy, security, and data before maybe even we talk about the birds and the bees. So what age are you talking about here?
So I guess this is a question. Again, you have a lot of parents listening to this show. And so if parents are going to have the privacy, security, and data permanence conversation before the sex talk, the question to the listener is to help is how do we spark a global conversation about what that conversation sounds like?
Well, Jared, you're actually on a global campaign to prevent people from uploading sonograms for unborn people.
I'm very anti-posting sonograms online because I believe that at a minimum, parents should be able to at least get their child's consent with a wink or a subtle smile before they come out of the womb.
Well, you can't get approval of that one way or the other, though, I guess. So it's like people talking about circumcision and they say, can't get approval, so you shouldn't have the right to circumcise a kid.
But the fact of the matter is that when you're born, at least the only thing known about you is your sonogram picture. But over your life, more and more of your identity is going to now be driven by the things that you do, the things that people say about you, the sort of pictures of where you are, the things that you post, and that over time, the percentage of your own identity that you personally control declines as you have life's accomplishments. And because there's essentially no delete button on the internet, this stuff just piles up.
Eric, as you pointed out on a number of occasions, Google, in the spirit of doing no evil and everything, is not tracking people. But the fact of the matter is, you've also said on a number of occasions, we can find out anything we want to know about anybody, really. Well, and you can.
But as a company, we don't do that. And in particular, we don't track people for precisely all the reasons that you could imagine. The fact of the matter is that technology naturally collects data about things. So typical example, your phone knows where you are because of E911 services. I don't think people want that broadcast, but nevertheless, the phone has to know where it is. It's the government, it's the laws, it's good judgment of businesses that prevents that stuff from being misused.
And Jared, you were going to add something here? Jared Cohen?
Well, we take a place like Saudi Arabia. It's similar to the U.S. in the sense that young kids are going to start using technology at an earlier age. And so imagine a mother having a conversation with her daughter about not saying and doing certain things online that could have an impact given the laws in Saudi Arabia. So we try to look at this question of privacy and security not just in the context of the first 2 billion, but in the context of the next 5 billion.
Well, you've been traveling all over the world. You've gone to some 40 countries together, including a visit to North Korea, which got a good deal of publicity. Let's talk about that for a minute because you went there with former Governor Bill Richardson in New Mexico, and I think what you want to do is get some U.S. citizens sprung, didn't you?
Well, we had a number of objectives. Obviously, with the American citizen who's in detention there, we were very concerned about his safety, and things have only gotten worse for him as he's been convicted now in what appears to be a kangaroo court for 15 years of imprisonment. And the fact of the matter is that conditions in North Korea are very, very harsh. The thing that was most disturbing about North Korea was the absence of doubt. In all the other countries that I've been to, people understood that the country was screwed up in some way. But we could detect no sense that there was an alternative model to the North Koreans. Our thesis is that the presence of the internet, the presence of curiosity, the presence of seeing alternative points of view will ultimately cause that government to upgrade itself, to reform, and to become less dangerous.
That it seems to be a working thesis, and yet let's look at the data here because, in fact, we had Wael Goim on the forum soon after that major change took place. It was called the Arab Spring, and a lot of people say those who were using social networks were not those who succeeded Mubarak. I mean, it's a Muslim Brotherhood leader now, and you could say the same thing to some extent in Tunisia and Libya, and certainly the Iranian Green Revolution didn't have the results that many hoped it would have because of this populist uprising through the social media.
Well, in the new digital age, one of the arguments we make about the future of revolutions is that they're going to be easier to start and harder to finish. And what we mean by that is, yes, technology can get lots of people into the streets around a common idea of getting an autocrat out of power, but technology can't create leaders overnight that are not there. It can't create institutions overnight that are not there. So you have a lot of heroes and celebrities of revolutions who hopefully over time will be backfilled with leadership skills, and we have to wait and see.
So for those countries who have a history of no real privacy, it's going to be more difficult to find any kind of infrastructure that would allow. That's what you say in your book.
Right? Well, privacy and laws around privacy descend from the notion of individual rights. And many of these countries have no concept of individual rights at all. People are very much at the whim of the local policeman, the local mayor, an unelected government, and so forth. So for those countries, the concept of privacy, the empowerment, is a very, very big change. For countries like the United States and Western Europe and so forth, we have long traditions of rights of privacy. Those rights, by the way, differ by country, and our countries will sort them out. There will be changes in laws, changes in regulations that reflect the changes in technology.
We're talking with Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohen about their new book, The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. Jared, technology, some argue, makes it much easier for terrorism, and Boston is often cited particularly because of the internet connections, Al-Awlaki, and his lecturing and bomb-making and all that. You seem more optimistic.
Obviously, terrorism is a challenge that's been around since the beginning of time, and it will persist into the future. What's changed is in the future, it's impossible to imagine a terrorist being relevant in a cave in Tora Bora. So if every terrorist in the future is going to opt into technology, ultimately, they're going to leave a digital trail. There's a long tradition of several things, which is terrorists being young and young people making mistakes. And the combination of those two things plus technology equals a digital trail.
Well, in fact, we tell the story. We tell the story in the book in Afghanistan that we heard from the SEALs, where the 26-year-old rebel commander who was a member of the Taliban, who had done a very good job of evading them by not using his cell phones, all of a sudden gets a phone call because he wants to go to his cousin's wedding. And he's intercepted just like that. It's very, very hard to hide yourself from the legitimate authorities in an era where everything is interconnected.
And you make the argument, for example, that technology is going to help do such things as bust Mexican drug cartels. But you also don't mince words about what harm it can create and the kinds of harms it creates. I mean, the genie's out of the bottle. The Pandora's box has been opened.
Well, we talk about our Mexico experience because on the one hand, you can imagine and you feel great sympathy for the government and the citizens who are the victims of this terrible set of drug wars. But you also worry that the infrastructure that's being put in place could allow for the violation of the privacy rights of future citizens and future governments of Mexico.
And when Eric and I went to Ciudad Juarez, which of course is known by many as the murder capital of the world, it seemed that there was nobody more concerned about their privacy than the police officers, who were so concerned about their identities being known to the drug cartels that they wore face masks. What's interesting is enter the internet, and you have an entire population in this city who are online using their real names, reporting where crimes are, reporting where the violence is, and essentially using the internet as their face mask.
And let's talk about cybersecurity because we keep hearing all these caveats about the whole cyber universe could go crashing. It could be undermined completely. Cybersecurity. And China comes off, if I may say so, in your book as somewhat of a villain. And I mean, in terms of stealing secrets.
There's no question as to the facts there. The U.S. government this week issued a detailed analysis of Chinese government behavior, which, of course, they completely denied.
So what's – I mean, there's really in some ways no – telling, no forecasting. I mean, you're not futurist in terms of the real dangers here, is there?
Well, one way to understand this is that we want to sound the alarm so that people begin to plug the holes, deal with the issues. There's been a historic concern that foreign governments would, for example, attack the power grid or the water system or so forth, and those systems are being hardened. For you as an individual, and Jared makes the point that we want to articulate this, is what can you do? Well, what you can do as an individual is make sure you don't use the same password everywhere. This, of course, is what the AP Twitter people just learned when they issued this sort of tweet that took off that took down the market for a while. And also don't download malware, bad software. One of the best ways you can do that, sorry for the ad, is use Google Chrome, which, of course, is free.
Since you mentioned Twitter, I have to get a quote of yours out, Eric, which it reminded me of Bob Newhart's old bit about the monkeys typing and everything. He said, if you want Twitter and analysis, it's like a monkey typing a work of Shakespeare. I like that. That's one to keep in mind. Let's talk a little bit with you, Jared, about the difference here between the individual and the nation state. Well, actually, let me go even more macro here. There's a lot of concern about nation states actually being overtaken by or supplanted by the corporate world, and particularly big companies, Google, Microsoft, and so forth. You see that?
Well, I think that – I mean, there's no doubt that technology is playing an increasingly important role in the world, but there are certain things that ultimately only nation states will be able to do. So yes, citizens are becoming more powerful, but states will continue to be the dominant unit in the international system. What we say in the book is that 57% of the world's population is currently living under autocratic regimes. Those are the environments where the technological infrastructure has not been built yet, and there's only so many companies in so many countries that have the ability to build that infrastructure. And there's two choices, open or closed. And this is why we talk about competing spheres of cyber influence, one that favors, you know, more surveillance, which is, again, the Chinese-type model, and one which favors more openness, which is the Western model.
And so who has more power, as you see, the reshaping of the future, the individual, the state, or the corporation?
Well, our view is whether you're a corporation, whether you're an individual, or whether you're a government, you're going to increasingly split your time between the physical and the virtual world.
I would argue that the individual, the thing that's new is the empowerment of the individual. You know, corporations have always had power, and countries have certainly always had power because they've had guns and weapons and things like that. But now the citizens have something that they can use to counteract the company and the country.
And if I could add to what Eric's mentioning, nowhere is this going to be more true than in education. Let's look at how many young people in the environments where the next 5 billion are coming online are educated. Their governments educate them through rote memorization. So when all of these students have smartphones in their hand, they're going to be able to use that as a very important and powerful vehicle to challenge rote memorization with critical thinking.
Eric, you mentioned Google products, and I have to just voice here and get some response to you because I was at this big event for tipping point, and there were Google glasses going around. They were auctioning them off for princely sums. And the fact of the matter is, you know, it's pretty – I put a pair on. It's a pretty fascinating thing to look through. I can tell you that. It's exciting. At the same time, you know, that there's a lot of people saying this is going to be information overload. Everybody's going to become a paparazzi or the target of a paparazzi, and a lot of worry about it.
You know, people have said this about every new technology. Google Glass is clearly a technological breakthrough that we've never sort of seen before. Excuse for the pun. And what we've done is we've distributed about 2,000 of them to developers, and we're going to watch and see how they do it. We're acutely aware as a company about the privacy concerns, the issues of misuse, what happens if they're stolen, those sorts of things. And so we'll see what happens with this first 2,000.
As a professor, I keep thinking about kids wearing glasses and, you know, cheating on exams.
Well, again, you can imagine a whole new set of social etiquette will be invented for when it's appropriate to be wearing Google Glass and when it's appropriate not to. There's obviously times and places where it's not appropriate. The fact of the matter is you have the same issues with telephones and with cameras and so forth. As a professor, it's amazing now. People, professors sit there. Students are online at the same time. How do you know if your students are actually listening to you or playing games? You never know.
You guys seem pretty bullish about online education, almost like the 3D stuff that you're very strongly in favor of here.
Well, many industries have not had any sort of new dynamic competition in a very long time. And the internet brings real sort of multi-factor competition, right? Real choices to every industry. It's why it continues to reshape these industries. In the case of education, the fact of the matter is that we can now try new models, of which there's a number. I'm on the board of something called the Khan Academy, which is fantastic. And we can measure the outcomes and decide who's right.
We've done shows with Khan, and, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this on the air here in programming. But a lot of academic people are they kind of find it chilling.
Well, the fact that they find it chilling does not make it wrong. And what's interesting about academics is academic teachers teach statistics and A-B tests. So why don't we apply to education the same principles? Let's do choice A and choice B and see which models produce the best learning. That's how you choose the best outcomes. We're in a global race for competitiveness. Education is the solution to most of our problems. The investment of education, better education, global education, educating everybody, on and on and on. Let's make sure we're doing it in the perfect way.
So we're talking about let's get back to the global politics or the geopolitics here. Are we talking about opening up new markets in, well, I think you call it Myanmar. I still call it Burma. But, you know, places like that, which have been certainly mostly known for the oppression of people.
Well, we were in Myanmar.
Violation of human rights? Excuse me. Yeah.
We were in Myanmar about a month and a half ago, and an interesting observation that we came away with is less than 1% of the population has access to the internet, yet everybody seems to have heard of it. And they understand the internet in democratic terms as something that is going to give them more choices, more opportunities, allow them to bear witness to crimes or religious persecution. So what happens in the future in Myanmar or somewhere else when everybody has heard of the internet and understands it in a democratic way and their governments try to build a closed surveillance internet? What does that tension look like and how does it play out?
But in Myanmar, you have another example. You have a very dangerous point. The generals have decided to release the lady, as she's known, Aung San Suu Kyi. This has been true for about 18 months. They've had freedom, and now all of a sudden the laws are coming in.
I should mention, for listeners who don't know, that was a Nobel Prize-winning leader and daughter of the leader of Burma for many years.
Yeah. And she is, in fact, the Nelson Mandela of Asia, I think, at this point. The fact of the matter is we don't know what's going to happen. As sectarian violence starts to happen, as people start to misuse the media to promote their own causes, will fear Trump justice and will people go back to more repressive outcomes? We argue that the internet guarantees some level of openness, but it in and of itself does not generate a full-functioning open democracy.
Yeah, Jared Cohen.
And in the process of writing this book, Eric and I have essentially, you know, begun to develop a message for autocrats and dictators around the world about the things that are about to happen that they cannot stop. One, they are not going to be able to commit crimes against their people and do so in a news blackout. Two, they're not going to be able to continue to grow their economies in meaningful ways if they don't open up. Three, they're not going to be able to stop smuggling of information in the way that they had in the past when people would bring it on mules on switchbacks over borders because content passed in the online world doesn't need to find a way under a fence or over a wall.
I was struck, by the way, by how powerful information is in these places. We were in South Sudan, not a place I would recommend visiting. And we learned about the war that's going on the boundary between South Sudan and Sudan. how is information getting into this war-torn and very, very dangerous area? People are smuggling in micro SD cards that go into feature phones to get information. Information is so much more powerful than you could possibly imagine.
Oh, when there's a hunger for it, there will find a way. I want to get back to privacy, though, if we can for a moment, because New York Times reported that European regulators said that Google has been insufficiently forthcoming, I think was the phrase, about its use of personal data, especially when information was used across different services for purposes like Adverti.
We actually disagree with that criticism from the European Commission. If you go and you actually read what we disclosed everything that we were doing and all the things that we might do, although I suspect it's unlikely we would do a lot of it. That was an insufficient disclosure. I don't know how to make a bigger disclosure. Partly this is oppositional. It's in their interest to be opposed to us. But the fact of the matter is there's infinite amounts of data about what we're doing, how we're doing it, why we're doing it, and people have a clear choice.
Sure. Isn't there a problem? I mean, you guys are both technologists, both leaders in the technology field. You've co-authored this book. You understand the nuances and much of the subtlety of this world that's opening up before us and opening up quicker than most of us can digest. But that's part of the problem, I think. You have world leaders and you have policymakers here in the United States who don't understand the technology, who are really illiterate when it comes to the technology.
Well, in some respects, the gap that exists between generations with regards to knowledge around technology is in some respects creating an opportunity for what we describe as reverse mentorship. So the message, as we've been out and about on this book tour and talking to a lot of young audiences at universities, is every single one of them, regardless of what they want to go into in terms of their field, has an innate knowledge and expertise on technology just by virtue of the generation that they were born into. And so it's their comparative advantage going forward. And a smart leader asks their young people who work in their offices or nearby how they should be leveraging technology.
So talk about why you think there's an NGO bubble.
So part of the reason we're concerned about an NGO bubble is there's, you know, ultimately NGOs rely on funders. And there's an increasing number of NGOs, in fact, a rapidly proliferating number of NGOs, and still just about the same amount of money to go around. And in some respects, you can reach a point where you almost have too many options, and there's so much activity that it becomes difficult to focus. So if you look at the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti, I think there were something like 30,000 NGOs operating in Haiti. If I'm an altruistic individual and I want to help, or I'm a group of individuals and I want to help, how am I supposed to determine which of those 30,000 NGOs I should be working with?
Eric Schmidt, as we come up upon the break here, you seem pretty bullish in the book on jobs increasing, and yeah, job losses have been pretty hemorrhaging in conjunction with the new technology. Jeremy Rifkin and others have written about this. Why the optimism?
You know, the development of a global middle class creates markets for American firms, American brands, and so forth, which is quite profound. The American educational system continues to produce the top entrepreneurs. We have the top research universities in the world, 18 of the 20 of them. There's every reason to believe that if we simply allow the entrepreneurial spirit of America to grow, we will do just fine, that the jobs will be there. I don't see an alternative, right? We're not going to go back to farming. We're not going to go back to low-tech manufacturing. We need to invest in these areas, and I think we can do so. We've faced these challenges before as a country, and we've overcome them.
Well, our guests are the co-authors of a new book, Google Chair Eric Schmidt and Director of Google Ideas Jared Cohen, here with us in studio talking about the new digital age reshaping the future of people, nations, and business. You may want to lend your voice, and in fact, we invite you to do that. If you have a question or comment for our guests, or if you simply like to join the conversation, our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. And in this new age of technology, you can also email us, forum at kqed.org. Go to our Facebook page, tweet us, our Twitter handle's at kqedforum, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. When we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Google's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt, says that between Facebook and cloud computing, quote, your digital identity will live forever. Schmidt and his co-author, Jared Cohen, are joining us in studio for this hour to talk about their book, The New Digital Age, which explores how online connectivity is changing censorship, privacy, and activism in countries like Mexico, China, North Korea, and elsewhere around the world. Again, Eric Schmidt is executive chair of Google and co-author of the book. Jared Cohen is director of Google Ideas and also co-author. He also was part of the staff and served under Secretaries of State Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton. Talking, we'll get to your calls, by the way, and you can join us. This is a wide-ranging conversation, but if you have something you'd like to contribute or add to the conversation, there are a number of ways you can do that. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum at kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also, of course, tweet us, our Twitter handle, at kqedforum, or go to our Facebook page. Talking just a moment off-air about the fact that, and I know you had virtuous intentions here to write a book about the good and the bad and in terms of the interconnectivity and what's up ahead, reshaping our future, and wanted to show that there are good sides, bad sides, good people, bad people. But the argument that I've heard for so many years is that the internet and technology, they're just tools. And they're tools that can be used and used the wrong way or used the right way. But there are also tools that were fashioned by human beings who were fallible, and there are tools that are used by human beings. And consequently, you get into this whole, I don't want to get too philosophical here, but range of arguments having to do with the fact that they perhaps in many ways move us in directions that we can't predict and in directions perhaps even away from our humanity. I remember arguing with Howard Rangel early on about virtual reality as opposed to reality, that kind of thing.
We do talk about this in the book, The New Digital Age, and the core point to make is that there is a technological bias in the internet. It's a bias of empowerment. It empowers individuals. Empowering individuals means empowering the very good people, which is the vast majority of people in the world, and a few bad people. And we have to worry about what the bad people are doing. But the fact of the matter is this bias for empowerment drives everything.
Well, what about the distance that the internet creates? Let's just talk about that for a minute with you, Jared. And by distance, I mean you hear people complaining about the fact that they meet online. They don't meet. They meet virtually all the time, or they make acquaintanceships or friendships online, and they don't have the advantages of that we used to have when we sat face to face. Let's put it that way. I mean, you can spread that out in a macro level, obviously.
I think it's an easy argument to make when you can travel at ease, when you're not restricted. But think about all the people who in the world will never leave their village. For social reasons, economic reasons, gender discrimination reasons. What the internet does is it allows them to meet people and go to places that they would never otherwise be able to go to. The average citizen will meet so many more people virtually than they will ever encounter physically, and that leads to more perspectives, that leads to more ideas, that leads to overall more choices.
Just getting back to, and I do want to get our listeners on this, but Eric, getting back to taxes for a moment, looking at an article out of London. It says, politicians in Germany and France say they will press for Google to be quizzed on corporate income tax after a Reuters report highlighted how the company employs sales staff in the UK while telling the tax authorities that sales are made from Ireland. Currently, Google has no taxable presence in France, Germany, or Britain in relation to its advertising business, from which it makes almost all its profits, allowing the company to operate almost tax-free in these countries.
You know, we follow all the laws in Europe, and it turns out that the structure that has been erected closes and does business through Ireland, which is a common mechanism that's used by U.S. companies and foreign companies dealing with Europe. This is how our international tax regime works. And while it's certainly true that these governments could certainly use more money, the fact of the matter is that we have to follow the law, and the law says this is the best way to operate.
Is it following the law or using the law in what would be described perhaps as a loophole way?
It's certainly not a loophole. It's highly, highly legal and is done very commonly.
Let's bring our callers into the discussion. We go first to John. Good morning.
Morning. I just have two questions. First of all, I'm wondering why the flip-flop on CISPA not supporting and turning around this last bout to support it as it moves to the House.
It's the Cyber Intelligence Act, yeah.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, I just mentioned what CISPA is, the Cyber Intelligence Act.
Exactly. I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Second point, Julian Assange just released his new book, kind of a dud in my point of view as well. But anyways, one of the things he's arguing for is greater encryption for protecting, you know, political activists, if you will, moving forward. I'm just wondering if either of you have personal feelings, if you support the Tor project or had anything to comment about that new book.
You know, on the CISPA bill, we have worked through our trade association, which does support CISPA. We've not taken a very strong view of it. We have concerns over some of the privacy implications of CISPA. And on the support of Tor and other technologies, I think it'd be fair to say, Jared, that encryption is something that's a new change for many people. It's very powerful. It can be used for good or for evil.
And I would say free expression is such a high priority for Google, but there's also a larger technology story, which is more people have visibility into the access security and information publishing challenges in places like Iran and North Korea and Syria than at any other time in history. And so now what we have is lots of smart engineers figuring out the next best way to promote free expression.
Let me thank the caller, and we go right to another caller, and that's you. Naresh, good morning.
Hi, good morning. My name is Naresh Sehgal. I'm calling to ask if the way things have panned out in cloud computing and with Google and Facebook, if this places a lot of power in the hands of a couple of corporations around the world, and probably what the world needs in the sense of true democracy and a distributed computing is a lot of little Googles spread around the world instead of hegemony of one or two companies. What do you think?
What do you think, Eric Schmidt?
Well, I think it's important to understand that there are limits on the power of corporations. Corporations are not countries. And if you take a look, for example, with cloud computing, the leading cloud computing vendor, if you're a startup, it's probably Amazon Web Services. Google, of course, has a competitor there that's quite good called Google Compute Engine. There's other entrants coming in. It's a pretty highly competitive market, and I think that competition benefits everybody. I don't agree with you that you should have lots of little Googles. I think that having a number of very well-funded global firms that are competing very, very tough against each other is a very stable and a very, very pro-competitive structure.
You know, I'm wondering when you talk about corporations and the whole question of their power. I did an event for Siebel Scholars, and one of your pluggers, Neil Ferguson, was there along with Ralph Nader. And you can imagine how polarized the argument was. I felt like I was at a pugilist match and had to almost interfere. I thought they were going to come to blows. But, you know, the arguments were so polarized. On the one hand, you had Nader saying corporate power, terrible, horrible.
But he's been saying that since he was born.
Well, he's still saying it. And Neil Ferguson defending corporations, saying they don't have power. They have a lot of corporate responsibility, a lot of – I mean, the argument seems to me to be almost analogous, if I may say so, to what you're saying about the Internet. That is good and the bad.
No, but let's be clear that corporations, the modern corporation is not just a profit-seeking venture. The modern corporation has employees, it has customers, it has a community, it has a social responsibility. Google tries to exemplify this, as do many others. We care a lot about our reputation, the way we treat people and so forth. It's part of our brand and it's something that's very meaningful. With respect to the Internet, it's best, I think, to say that with the empowerment of every individual, you get the good and the bad individuals. When the Internet was originally designed, we didn't think there would be bad people on it, so we didn't even have encrypted passwords or things like this. Of course, today we have very sophisticated systems to do that. We also did not anticipate that governments would use the Internet to attack each other, which again is beginning to occur. These are problems which technologically can be addressed.
Well, with the power of corporations, particularly with Citizens United, would you concede that you have the bad and the good?
Well, Citizens United is a political decision or a legal decision, depending on your point of view. But the fact of the matter is that that is a decision made by the citizens of the United States through their elected officials and through the Supreme Court.
Here's a listener right on point, Chris, who writes on our website, "It seems like for a long time Google was able to keep somewhat true to their famous slogan, 'Don't be evil.' But at this point, with their mechanical but voracious conquest of information, they are such a global corporate behemoth that they can't help but be corporate, efficient, and cold. While this may or may not be evil, it is certainly amoral." I'm not sure what he means, but...
Well, it would be helpful if the questioner would offer some facts in his defense, because I completely disagree with everything he just said. Google as a company is run under a set of principles to try to get information to empower people. We take our mission of making the world a better place very, very seriously, and I would offer self-driving cars, Google Glass, all of the innovations that people get and the enormous offerings that we have that are free as examples of our commitment to making the world a better place and serving the citizens of the world.
Maybe even immortality. I told you we had Ray Kurzweil on. Here's another listener, Arthur, who writes, "The Electronic Communications Privacy Act is technologically obsolete because of the cloud and cheap storage. Email older than 6 months is subject to search without warrant. And when the individuals store their data in the cloud, they no longer have control of response to subpoena. Should there be no time limit? Should the owners of data have the right to intervene in a subpoena? And how else would we amend the ECPA?" And then he goes on to say, what do you suggest about the future of software patents? The real problem, functional claiming, is suggested by Stanford law professor Mark Lemley.
Well, I love the fact that you have very sophisticated listeners.
So do I.
In the case of the electronic privacy, these acts will, in the process of extension, get updated to the new technological points. The fact of the matter is that we operate under these laws today. We've done pretty well. With respect to the patent things, there's a lot of problems with patents, especially with software patents. Google has worked very hard to get those changes in place. Some of them are in place. Some of them are not. The patent industry moves very, very slowly. It's time to rethink our approach to patents in this country.
Bring another caller on, and that's you, Kevin. Join us.
Hey, good morning. Two quick questions. One, as far as the taxes, basically offshoring profits that corporations do, and the comment made by the guest that Google's just using tax laws, not taking advantage of them, perhaps, but as I heard on Terry Gross's Fresh Air only yesterday, corporations have, as some might guess, armies of lobbyists and influence peddlers, often ex-feds, almost all of them who line the walls of Washington, D.C. institutions, who have pressed for these laws, and then they guess forgive me for not remembering his name, yesterday on Fresh Air was saying it is impossible for the citizen to do anything about this, and the elected officials are either overwhelmed or bought off, and the result is that we have a banking system that is as weak as it was, and they're allowed to basically offshore these derivatives, but the same problem and vulnerability exists that the American people will have to pick up. I would love to see Google take up the charge to change the tax laws. That would be doing good, and then everyone would benefit. And as far as the privacy issue, on a switching a topic here, I am annoyed personally that everywhere I go, even if I go to comment on KQED's forum, I'm prompted to log in with my Facebook account or Twitter account. And sometimes there's no way around that. As far as, in addition to not having one password, I don't want to have one online identity where I'm forced to basically make everything public right to my name.
Well, Kevin, I'm glad you brought that up because in their book they talk about multiple identities, exponential identities,
so,
really.
On the U.S. tax question, which has nothing to do with the tax matter
that you brought
up earlier, there are some limits to what Google can do. But I would suggest that the government that America has was elected by Americans last time I checked. And I would encourage people who are unhappy with the behavior of our government to get out and get much more active in the political process. There's so many tools with which you can now understand what your representatives are doing and hold them accountable. And that's the face of modern democracy.
The main tool in politics, though, is money. You would certainly concede. And if
having spent a lot of time with politicians, the main tool is whether they get elected or not.
Well, that's based on how much money and revenue they have.
Not necessarily. You'd be surprised. It actually does matter in America that you get the most votes, and we have a legal and honest voting system here. And there are limits to corporate power, to individual donations, and so forth. The best idea can actually win if people actually pay attention.
Jared Cohen.
To the question of multiple identities online, which, Michael, you were just getting at.
We're not talking about three faces of Eve here.
Not three faces of Eve, but the average individual, and certainly your listeners, I'm sure, have multiple email accounts, multiple social networking profiles, multiple chat services. That is your virtual entourage. Now, take that concept and think about a place like China. 1.3 billion people all with a virtual entourage. In the future, the population of countries will be 10 to 100 times the size in cyberspace that they are in the physical world.
We should mention, by the way, that in your book, you spent some time talking about WikiLeaks. And I'm looking at a listener's email. Julianne writes, I would love to hear what your guests have to say in response to Julian Assange's new book, Cyberpunks, asserting that the Internet is a threat to civilization itself due to the government's new capacity to create a permanent searchable archive of nearly all communications. Have we already built the mechanism of total oppression?
I have not read his book. Jared, have you read it yet?
I have not read his book, but what I will say in our book, The New Digital Age, we, a couple of years ago, went to interview Julian Assange, and it was not to engage in the well-publicized and well-documented debate of today, which is, you know, how problematic WikiLeaks was, et cetera. What we wanted to understand is, what does a Julian Assange in 10 years look like? And Eric, I know you have some specific views about how there won't be many of them.
Well, what was interesting about Julian's perspective was that he argued, and I think relatively convincingly to us, and we report this in the book, that if you are a government and if you're going to plan evil that's systematic, you'll have to write it down. And in his view, the best antidote to systematic evil is the automatic leaking of that information to hold people accountable, to hold these evil governments, in his view, accountable. I'm not endorsing this. I'm simply reporting his view.
So does that mean Bradley Manning should stay in jail?
Again, I'm not endorsing any of that. What I'm saying is that the problem with his argument, as best I could tell, is who gets to decide what information gets leaked. He views himself as the correct arbiter of that. And I don't know why, you know, he was chosen by society to do this, but nevertheless, that's his view. But what we also discovered is that it's much harder to be someone like Julian in the future. And again, I'm not commenting about his criminal issues and so forth. What we're saying is that in order to get the information that you're going to leak, you have to have the trust of the leaker. And it turns out to be quite difficult to get that. And so the likelihood of there being thousands of WikiLeaks sites and so forth, which many people thought a few years ago, is much less likely. And we report this in the book.
Listener writes, CEO Schmidt slipped in a pitch for using the Google Chrome web browser. It is fast and efficient, but I stopped using it recently because, unlike the other major browsers, Chrome now bombards users with pop-under ads that none of the ads blockers can stop. I don't have this problem with Firefox, Safari, or Microsoft Internet Explorer. I guess Don't Be Evil is yesterday's news.
I'd have to look at that particular scenario because I don't think that's true at all. Chrome itself does not show ads. Chrome is just a straightforward browser, and it's by far the most modern browser. It's also the fastest. It's by far the safest. It's never been broken. If you want to have a safe experience on the internet, I recommend using Chrome.
Another listener on our website puts this. Ramin writes, what would you think the psychological effects are on the very young who are growing up with digital connectivity as they grow up, as people become more and more isolated from each other by interacting less physically and instead spend most of the time behind a screen? Would there be any adverse effects for the next generation due to lack of actual real human interaction? I brought this up before, and I know you have some strong feelings, Jared, so go.
And maybe I have strong feelings because I'm an aspiring parent, not an actual parent yet. But I do believe that it still comes down to parenting. Parents have a choice of, do you put the tablet on the table at dinner or do you not? Do you play catch with your kids outside or not? I have very distinct memories of playing on the street with other kids. My parents would encourage me to go outside. Parents can still do that in the future.
Well, and Jared, you argue very strongly that the new world, the new digital age, is not a substitute for judgment.
Correct. And also, I always like pivoting towards the developing world because it's very easy to get concerned about this in the context of the 2 billion people who are already connected, but think about what the ability to connect will mean to the next 5 billion who, again, can't leave their villages, who don't necessarily have the same rights, who don't have the same choices. When we were in Pakistan, we met kids who go to school and the teacher doesn't show up. And so they sit in a classroom all day in what's known as ghost schools.
Eric Schmidt, I threw a tough quote last hour at Mark Bittman from The Atlantic. I'll throw one from you. It's actually something he said to The Atlantic editor James Bennett at the Washington Ideas Forum in 2010. With your permission, you give us more information about you, about your friends, and we can improve the quality of our searches. We don't need you to type at all. We know where you are. We know where you've been. We can know more or less what you're thinking about.
You'll notice the first part of that was the word, with your permission. And it's clear that computer systems will be able to mimic a great deal of human intelligence. Ray Kurzweil, who I know has been your guest, is very much the expert on this. And the fact of the matter is that we can build an almost infinitely valuable personal assistant with your permission. This is a device, a computer, a phone, and so forth that can make suggestions for you, can make your life better. A lot of people will like that, and a lot of people will say, I don't want it. It's your choice.
Talking about choice, a question from a listener named Randy. Please ask Eric Schmidt for his thoughts on Bitcoin. Does he foresee Google embracing cryptocurrencies in the future?
On the general subject of Bitcoin, which has been in the news today, I would offer you the following. Do a Google search and look up volatility of Bitcoin and then decide how you want to behave.
Okay. So instructed, listeners, and let me bring another caller on here. And that's Shell. Good morning.
Good morning. I had heard a quote regarding technology and the information and I'm wondering if it's correct. It was a trilateral commission meeting, and Rockefeller had expressed his appreciation because technology had advanced to the point of sophistication where the meetings were not necessarily needing to be, you know, kept there and, you know, and confidential. I just had that question if anybody was familiar with that.
Jared, are you familiar with this?
I'm not familiar with this specific quote, but I think it's safe to say in the future people will continue to have meetings that are both private and not private.
I think that's safe to say. Again, we're talking with Jared Cohen, who is director of Google Ideas, and Eric Schmidt, who is executive chairman of Google. Their new book, which they co-authored, is The New Digital Age, Reshaping the Future of People, Nations, and Business. I get back to a point that came up when Lieutenant Governor Newsom was here, and that was just the apathy, particularly here in the West. I mean, when you're talking about developing countries, of course, there's a lot of your excitement is somewhat infectious about the possibilities and everything. But in terms of galvanizing the citizenry, there's a lot of apathy here, and apathy is a terrible thing in terms of sparking or igniting populism.
Now, if you compare and contrast the United States to Japan. A fine country, a well-run country whose economic role has been largely passed for the moment, and a political system that does not seem to allow Japan to sort of come back roaring in a way that it should. A fine and wonderful country where is it apathy? Is it culture? Is it a system that's not allowing creativity? It's very, very important that we remember that America's strength has been in entrepreneurship, in driving change, in disruptive change, in new inventions. We're the world's leader in that. And there's every reason to believe that this next generation of people who are coming out of universities are capable of driving that. If you take a look at tech, which obviously we're very, very familiar with, you see a whole new generation of companies which aspire to be the next Google, the next Facebook, and some of them will. Huge investments, the venture model working and so forth. We're the dream of the world. So let's make sure that we continue to focus on that. That's where our economic growth will come from.
And you are listening to Forum. We're talking with Eric Schmidt and Jared Cohen. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, please go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller, and that's Michael from Berkeley. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I just wanted to disagree with your guest a bit about the connectivity and the detriment that can come about in the developing world that they currently don't have that we do have here. And I think that the harm could very greatly outweigh the benefits of being connected. And I think that's something that needs to be noted because I think it's something that is often not taken into
consideration. Anything something specific, Michael?
Yes. For example, the idea of spending one's time, like I think one of your guests was saying that he was a parent to be, and as a parent, I know that the reality of being connected as a parent does spill over to the children, and the children oftentimes are affected in ways in which we wish they would not, but we can't help it because of the ubiquitousness of the computer in the household, and I think that is something that needs to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, Eric Schmidt has a response.
I think with respect, I simply disagree with your point. With respect to computers in your household, someone put those in this household. It was presumably yourself or members of your family. You have a choice of not having them, turning them off. There is an off button. They can run out of batteries, what have you. When we visited in the third world, the hunger for knowledge is so powerful. And these devices, and they'll be primarily smartphones, will serve as the way to get healthcare information, the way to get education, the way to get entertainment. When we were in Myanmar, I said, well, what happened? They don't have any healthcare. I said, well, what happens when people get sick? And the person looked at me rather quizzically and said, they die. I mean, imagine a situation where all of a sudden with one device we can begin to fundamentally increase people's lifespans and quality of life. It's an extraordinarily powerful device.
You say, getting back to revolutions in different countries, you say it's unlikely that something like the Arab Spring would happen, say, in Latin America.
Well, there's something distinct about the Middle East and North Africa where you have a common language, where Arab identity in many respects trumps national identity, where the social networks in both the physical and virtual world extend throughout the entire region. You don't have that same dynamic in Latin America or across Asia or across Africa. But part of this is also, we argue in the new digital age that you need to look at future revolutions by country, not by region.
Michael has a question that you've probably often heard. Michael, join us.
Yeah, hi. I have a quick question. What happens to your digital soul after you physically die? I had a parent who had passed away. How do I get access to his digital profile? What are the laws around that? If it's a permanent ID, how is that going to be managed? And what is Google's or another company's rights to holding on to that?
Google has recently announced how we're going to handle the problem of your digital information after your death. If you look it up on Google, you'll see the way you do it, and you actually have to tell us what you want us to do with it. There's been a fair amount of discussion that there should be some laws with respect to this issue, and to clarify who gets the digital rights to information that you have after your death.
You've said on a number of occasions, Eric Schmidt, we're coming to the end of the hour here, no delete button, we need a debate about such things. I mean, a kid gets in trouble, maybe even serious trouble, it's on there for life.
Yeah, I think one of the sort of core points here is that in America, it's true in other countries as well, if you're a juvenile and you commit a crime, it's a modest crime, you serve your time or what have you, as an adult, you can actually petition to have it expunged. And so then you can legally say, were you ever convicted of a crime? The answer is no. And of course, the employer immediately goes to the web and they see this historical record and they conclude that you're a liar. We point out this not to say that we have a solution to this, but because it's a new problem. And the lack of a delete button does create these issues that society is going to have to address.
Well, a lot of important issues to address here. And again, the book is The New Digital Age. The co-authors, Jared Cohen, Eric Schmidt, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Good to have had you with us this morning. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Gucci. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll and executive producer Raul Ramirez. Let's mention our interns, Nora McCartan, Jasmine Wynn, Stefan Norgard, and Kelsey Dayton. For all of us here at KQED, and by the way, you can continue this discussion on our website. For all of us here, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.